This is The Guardian.
Welcome to Weekend, a podcast that helps you switch off from your busy day to day and find entertainment and inspiration in the best Guardian and Observer writing from the week. You can either listen to this as one podcast or play each article as individual listens. Just scroll down the description on the podcast page for the timings of what we are featuring. Coming up, can you smell what Dwayne The Rock Johnson is cooking? Could it be the most surreal US presidential bid yet? Asks Marina Hyde. Amina Sena meets the sociopath who learned to behave and found happiness. Why Gen Z has fallen in love with Sex and the City. And we find out, do our political opponents really hate us?
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Just a warning, there's a bit of bad language in this episode. Now, The Rock has never wanted to be in politics, you know. But if the people keep asking, he might just have to become America's final boss. By Marina Hyde. Read by Carlise Peer.
Where do you stand on The Rock? A question to which the answer can only be, please, not on his face. Wrestler, movie star, high-intensity interval philosopher, skincare entrepreneur, self-styled future presidential candidate. Personally, I believe that Mr. Dwayne Johnson is a net hilarity for humanity, though the idea he could ever truly limit himself to enriching the lives of only one species, or indeed only one planet, feels profoundly suspect. 2 weeks ago, The Rock graced Fox News with a lengthy interview, in which he announced he will be withholding his wildly coveted endorsement in the forthcoming US presidential election, having given it to Joe Biden last time. The reason? The Rock believes that very endorsement, his specifically, caused an incredible amount of division in our country. Evidently, The Rock judges himself a mega market mover in terms of American discord, so this time he is not declaring support for either Biden or Donald Trump. Quite a statement from a guy who 100% seems the type to have a tattoo of the words, "If you choose not to decide, you have still made a choice." Obviously not in English, in either Sanskrit, Latin or Hindi, curling around some sort of calf muscle called a trizaltoid or something that he's got a cool abbreviation for. Hashtag trizas. Hashtag gains never sleeps. Hashtag warrior poet. Anyway, the path to the Oval Office. The Rock assures the public that my goal is to bring our country together. As indicated, I yield to no one who says that contemporary America cannot be swiftly depolarized by men's grooming products, somewhat faltering action movies, and a board seat on the company that just sold the rights to WWE's Monday Night Raw to Netflix for $5 billion. Even so, could it be The Rock has more conventional plans for how to unify that great nation and is making his much-touted political move? Call it the Heartland Chokehold, even though that sounds like what happens to troubled interns who sleep with their congressmen and think it's something more. Could Johnson be offering citizens of the US the chance to have him as their final boss? And could he even be staking out a pitch? After all, in the wide-ranging sit-down with Fox, he also attacked woke culture, a development that some may judge reveals the direction this is all going in. That doesn't mean he's specifically picking a side. Although, listen, the Democrats and Republicans have apparently both asked him before. Last year, The Rock claimed that in late 2022, I got a visit from the parties asking me if I was going to run and if I could run. This is for president, supposedly. And honestly, given who the American electorate has voted for and may yet vote for again, could you even call it a comedy pick? Surely once they elected Trump to the White House, it permanently demeaned the office. A bit like when Jinder Mahal became WWE champion after pinning Randy Orton at Backlash 2017. Although, obviously, not as bad. As for The Rock, he also uses the Fox interview to insist, "My goal has never been to be in politics." Really? That seems odd, given the sheer volume of interviews in which he's on record saying stuff like the fact that running for president is a realistic consideration, alluring, and if it ever happens, it'd be my honour to serve. I get the feeling the honour would be all ours from day one, when Dwayne would ditch the famous resolute desk and replace it with what he calls my GSD, get shit done table that's inside my trailer. According to The Rock, this is where many productive meetings and big business deals have been sealed. And the table holds a lot of great mana, spirit slash power, and energy. In fact, it was probably from that very table that he sat down during the filming of Fast and Furious 8 and called his co-stars candy asses. Yep, this is a guy not afraid to go tit to tit with Vin Diesel, real name Mark St. Clair, and more importantly, not afraid to obliquely tell the world about it in a swiftly deleted social media post.
"When you watch this movie next April," The Rock explained back then, "and it seems like I'm not acting in some of these scenes and my blood is legit boiling, you're right."
Ooh. Well, funnily enough, he was saying something very similar recently when he followed a WWE opponent out to the car park for afters.
"I can't shut my high emotions off just because a script says we're done," claimed The Rock, even though he can. "But this is a microcosm of a larger issue I have with individuals, corporations, and governments, telling us what we can or can't do. You have to do it this way, you have to say it that way, or you'll get cancelled. Fuck that. I say it the way I want to say it. Totally."
And you know, without having to bring it back to his most recent tag team result, he and Roman Reigns did win against Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins last weekend. The guy is 51. How does he do it? No, but I mean, how does he do it in a way that can be discussed in a newspaper? Over to The Rock.
"Pushing myself physically, mentally, and psychologically to places I've never gone. Honored to share the ring, go to war in our squared circle and entrain the fans. Out of K's Fortuna Juvat."
And if those last three words sound to you like some kind of herbal supplement to which you could never get access, I am blown away to tell you that they are indeed Latin. Fortune does favour the brave, though whether the American electoral system does remains as yet tantalisingly unclear.
That was Can You Smell What The Rock Is Cooking? Could It Be The Most Surreal Presidential Bid Yet? By Marina Hyde. Read by Carlise Peer. Next, Patrick Gagné has spent most of her life fighting terrible urges. She is also a loving sister, daughter, mother and wife. Here, she tells Amina Sena what it's like to be a sociopath. Read by Rachel Hanshaw.
There is a slight flash in her eyes as Patrick Gagné describes what she calls the tug. The moment she imagines something she really shouldn't do and thinks, wouldn't that be fun? She laughs. What would once have been a compulsion can now be overpowered by logic and consequences. You want to take that car for a joyride? Yes. But if I did that, I'm probably going to have to answer for it. And do I want to? Not really. This isn't to say that Gagné wouldn't jump at an opportunity, if she could argue she wasn't at fault. It happened recently, she says. Waiting for her car, parked by a valet, she was given the keys to someone else's and drove off in it. They handed me the keys. And then I was like, she puts on a mock surprised voice. Oh, this is not my car. Her husband, when he heard, didn't love it, she says. She smiles as if to say, but what did he expect? In 2020, Gagné featured in the New York Times Modern Love series with the headline, He Married a Sociopath, Me. This led to her memoir, Sociopath, in which she writes about her lack of empathy and other emotions, and the destructive compulsions that once threatened to overwhelm her. The term sociopath is widely understood in popular culture. The chilly and ruthless politician or CEO, or, at its most extreme, the serial killer. But it isn't an official diagnosis. In the UK, it's an outdated term, now under the umbrella of antisocial personality disorder, which also includes psychopathic traits. Gagné has never been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. In the US, she was labeled a sociopath by a psychologist who got her to take the psychopathy checklist assessment, often used with offenders. Sociopaths, if we persist with the term, have a bad reputation. Not undeserved, she acknowledges. But she wanted to offer up the inner life of someone struggling, who didn't want to hurt people or do destructive things, and who did want to have fulfilling relationships. I was driven by the need to help others like me understand who they are, why they are. We speak over video call. Gagné at home on the East Coast. She is compelling, like a movie character. A sociopath who's beautiful, warm and funny, articulate and charming. She's a self-confessed liar, but her book details a woman struggling against her urges, and her deceit is largely about masking to fit in, not deployed, as far as I can tell, for power and control. Mind you, might a sociopath make me want to believe that? Can she recognize other sociopaths? Not really, she says. People want to believe that sociopaths are all evil, and it makes them easy to spot, therefore they're safe. People don't want to admit they might be working with a sociopath, sleeping next to a sociopath. They might have birthed a sociopath. But my goal is to take the stigma away so that we can have a more complete conversation about it. In her university library, Gagné struggled to find much about sociopathy. Older books made more sense to her. Reading a book written by a psychiatrist in the 1940s, the personality characteristics listed, including lack of remorse or shame, unreliability and untruthfulness, made sense to her. I remember reading these studies, some of which were decades old, and thinking, why aren't people talking about this? Other mental disorders get a lot of research and therefore treatment, but not, she realized, antisocial personality disorder, even though early intervention could prevent destructive behavior and could revolutionize the criminal justice system, she says. I think because these words have become synonymous with evil, people's compassion for them automatically drops. There's no incentive to help. Where, she says with a smile, is empathy for sociopaths? When you are a sociopathic kid, nobody's empathizing. Sociopaths are villainized for failing to demonstrate the exact same emotion they have never received themselves. That feeling of hopelessness, she thinks, can be a driving force in the escalation of destructive behavior. But the sociopaths we hear about are the extreme examples, and by only focusing on the extreme, we continue to exacerbate the problem. The majority of people who fall on the sociopathic spectrum fall on the moderate side, for whom treatment is possible. And that's what I want them to know. For Gagné, it felt reassuring to put a name to her experience, however much disagreement there is about it, and to see that it could be improved. Her treatment included cognitive behavioral therapy. For me, there is nothing inherently immoral about having limited access to emotion, she says. It's not what we feel, it's what we do. If destructive behavior is at play, the behavior needs to be addressed, first and foremost. Left untreated, it doesn't mean people become career criminals, she says. But they're certainly going to employ unhealthy coping mechanisms. Gagné did not become a career criminal. She worked in the music industry, then was a therapist, before she became a writer and advocate. But she had her moments. She was a compulsive thief and joyrider. As a child, she stabbed another girl in the head with a pencil. This wasn't, she insists, rooted in a drive to inflict pain. I just remember feeling this pressure building. And this girl just happened to be standing next to me when the dam burst. Certainly, she was grating on me in that moment, but I wasn't trying to hurt her specifically. The act, she says, resulted in a pressure release that I'd never experienced. Certainly, I can look back and can think logically that I wish she hadn't had to suffer in order for me to get that release. Gagné grew up in California, where her father was an executive in the music industry, then after her parents split up on the East Coast. She remembers realizing she was different from other people. Really early, she says. Just a subtle awareness that I wasn't experiencing things the way my classmates were. Their emotional reactions were very different than mine, and certainly my family's. She observed and imitated her younger sister's behavior, and that of other children at school, especially in relation to emotions. It was almost like learning a language, says Gagné. I would try to figure out the socially appropriate way to respond. It wasn't deliberately manipulative, she says. I understand that someone who is frequently dishonest, you're automatically going to equate that with evil, or someone who's out to get you. But that really was not the case. I didn't have the social tools everyone else seemed to have, so I mimicked theirs. An antisocial child, trying to survive in a pro-social world. Did she have many friends? Not really, but I was okay with it. She loved her family. The sociopathic personality isn't incapable of making those connections, especially her younger sister. We were just buddies from the start. I also didn't have that jealousy that comes with a lot of sibling relationships. Gagné was thrilled that her younger sister took attention away from her. I think without that rivalry element, we were able to exist cooperatively. At 14, at a holiday camp, she met another teenager, David. They had a brief relationship before getting together years later. They're now married and have two children. Before him, did she think she would be able to feel love for a partner? My concern was, is this going to be a real relationship, or am I going to have to fake it 90% of the time? Is there anyone out there with whom I will be able to be completely myself? Did she worry about becoming a mother? I remember holding out hope that when my first child was born, I would have that instant connection I had read about in books and seen in movies. When that didn't happen, I felt very disappointed. Is this going to be a situation where I can't connect? But ultimately, I love my kids. I didn't experience that instant connection, but I learned other women who do not have a sociopathic personality also experience that. She knew, she says, from the experience with her family and husband, that she was capable of love. So I never worried that I wouldn't love my children. Gagné finds it hard to describe how her urges felt. She doesn't have them to the same degree now. When she was younger, she struggled with her feeling of apathy, a grayish world, and she writes, "Doing something I knew was morally unacceptable was a way to force a pop of color. It was also that feeling of release. Was there a pattern to the compulsions? It didn't become concrete for me until later. But if I tried to ignore the urge or pressure, I had less control over the behavior." Gagné realized, she says, that regular, smaller acts of deviance would prevent a larger blowout. She came up with a list of rules, of which the first was no hurting anybody. I think it was important for me to set those boundaries, because they weren't inherent, she says. I knew what was right and wrong, but I was missing those complex emotional systems that tend to keep people in check. I had to write it down and talk myself through it. What is bad in the big sense? Well, that was easy. Violence. Instead, she would stalk strangers on the street. If they were unaware, she reasoned, it wouldn't hurt them. Truant from school and let herself into the houses her mother, an estate agent, had access to. Later, she taught herself to pick locks. But there were slips. Once she picked up a cat in the street and squeezed it harder and harder, feeling, she writes, euphoric, before she let it go. It frightened her. She didn't want to hurt animals. There are other things she left out of the book. I'd love to know what they are, given that she does include disturbing things, such as breaking into the property of a woman who is trying to extort money from her, and attending strangers' funerals, drawn in by the mourner's heightened emotions. My husband and I made a deal that I wouldn't show the pages to anyone else before he looked at them, she says. There were occasions where I would write something, and he would come in with a horrified expression like, "You can't show this! Burn your computer!" My editor jokes that he wants to get his hands on what he calls David's vault. Even now, I will say something or admit to something that someone who is neurotypical is going to find horrifying. But it just doesn't register that way to me. At university in Los Angeles, Gagné continued her acts of deviance, but she was struggling to understand her urges. At one point, she jumped from her window. Not a serious attempt at suicide, she now thinks. More a hope that it would somehow incapacitate her. Maybe if I was somehow compromised physically, I would no longer be at the mercy of my compulsions. I don't feel that way any longer, because I am very much in control of my behavior. I have a greater understanding of my personality type. After university, Gagné worked in the music industry. Does she think that world attracts sociopaths? If it's not a job prerequisite, it's certainly recommended. I think it helps to have moral flexibility in certain fields, and the music industry is definitely one of them. But that's why I made the decision not to pursue that career. It is sort of unchecked, and it was better to spend my time in a more structured environment that had clearer boundaries. So Gagné studied for a PhD and became a therapist. She thinks her detachment was helpful. If you are constantly projecting your own emotions into the session, they're not going to be able to process what they're feeling. There are other benefits to Gagné's sociopathic traits. When I look at other women who are struggling with self-worth, shame, are struggling to make other people feel more comfortable by making themselves less comfortable, that seems awful. And it's easy to say, I'm better off, that I don't have to deal with that. But conversely, women who have deep emotional ranges are able to connect much better than I can, to have those relationships that I don't have. She does have good friendships, she says. I am really fortunate to have friends who are both emotionally generous and non-judgmental. Can she be a good friend, empathic when she needs to be? She thinks so. If I have a friend who is experiencing something I can't directly relate to, I say, help me understand this. Other times, I just listen. Has she offended her friends by saying or doing the wrong thing? Of course, she says with a laugh. There are times where certain moments need sensitivity that I don't always grasp. But they will let me know that reaction was not great, and I can go, okay, I see that. As she wrote her book, Gagné started to understand herself more and to feel empathy growing. In writing about my experience as a child, I was able to empathize with other children who might be in the same position. And it was powerful. Sort of, oh, this is what it feels like. It felt hopeful, she says. It was like being on the right path.
That was I Didn't Want to Hurt That Girl I just felt this pressure building. The Sociopath Who Learned to Behave and Found Happiness by Amina Sena, read by Rachel Hanshaw. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be right back with the second half of this episode in a moment. Don't go anywhere.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome back to Weekend. Now, over a quarter of a century after its premiere, like many nostalgic creations, Sex and the City hasn't always aged well. But, insists Lydia Spencer Elliott, outdated attitudes aside, the friendship, fashion, and sex proves an eye-opener for a new generation of viewers as the show reruns on TV. Read by Carlise Peer.
A commitment-phobe boy had just dumped me when I first started watching Sex and the City. I had only been on this planet for just over a year when the show first aired, but the 25-year-old series came to me as a Manilow Blahnik-clad rite of passage when I needed it most. Many of my Gen Z peers are now meeting Carrie, Charlotte, Samantha, and Miranda for the first time, as the show was released on Netflix in the US last week. In the UK, you can watch it on Now TV or buy it on Amazon Prime. And older women can't help but wonder what Gen Z are making of it. The knee-jerk reaction has been to assume our age group would have a problem with the series. Not true. On my WhatsApp group chat with my friends, there are already fans. "I love the show," a 21-year-old friend voice notes me. "I enjoyed it more than I thought I would," another replies. Admittedly, we were all microdosing the best parts on social media way before we sat down to watch the series. Pinterest is full of Carrie-inspired looks. Silk skirts, mini dresses, vintage kitten heels. There's a viral TikTok of her saying, "And suddenly, there he was, wearing Armani on Sunday. Mr. Big," set to Take My Breath Away by Berlin, which more than 15,000 users have posted with outfit videos and clips of their boyfriends. This is the first time SATC has reached Gen Z via Netflix, but we know the law. Loathe the outdated opinions, love the friendship, the fashion, and the fucking. Still, we've got some qualms. Despite the tragically still relatable dating dilemmas, there are plenty of embarrassingly outdated attitudes. Carrie Bradshaw is fundamentally far too judgmental to be a sex columnist. When a younger guy she dates in season 3 reveals he's bisexual, she relentlessly roasts him. "I'm not even sure bisexuality exists. I think it's just a layover on the way to Gay Town." And eventually, he's dumped. "I was cringing," my friend messages me. "It reeks of biphobia." Samantha Jones is slut-shamed for giving a UPS delivery guy a sly blowjob in her office, fat-shamed when she gains 15 pounds yet still wants to wear a crop top, and is dismissed for being ridiculous when she starts a relationship with a painter called Maria in season 4. "She's not a lesbian. She just ran out of men." When Samantha dates a black music producer called Siobhan, one of the show's only non-white characters, she fetishizes him and announces, "I don't see color. I see conquests." When Miranda is apartment hunting, she tells her son they need to follow a white guy with a baby to find a good home. Donald Trump has a jump scare cameo in season 2, and all the girls casually use anti-trans slurs.
but in other ways, it's relatively progressive. I've never heard a group of women talking about shagging this much in any other show. It's not lost on me and my friends how revolutionary their chats about oral sex and masturbation would have been when it first aired. We all agree. It's still so refreshing seeing women talk freely about their sex lives. As a protagonist, Carrie is simultaneously iconic, morally confused, and intensely insufferable. When a man she's dating reveals he secretly films women having sex, she shrugs it off. When a different guy shares that he has ADHD, she dumps him. The verdicts among my peers vary from bad friend to self-obsessed. But she does turn out the best looks. Plus, we were all rooting for her and Big and their toxic fuckboy storyline the whole time. Truly, we're just as dumb as Carrie with our opinions on that one. Overall, it's a slay, the group chat concludes. Carrie, Samantha, Charlotte and Miranda's friendship is defo relatable because they literally just have brunch and talk about boys. No Bechdel test passing here, but that's not the point. Plus, they're certainly shagging more than us. I think my biggest takeaway, which I wasn't expecting, was that it inspired me to be more sexually liberated like the girls, one friend tells me. Date people casually, with no judgment. I was watching it like, what am I doing? I need to go and get some dick and not take life so seriously.
That was Shagging in Shoes, Why Gen Z Has Fallen in Love with Sex in the City by Lydia Spencer Elliott, read by Carlise Spear. Finally, do our political opponents really hate us? Not half as much as we think, according to the evidence. And, says professor in psychology and neuroscience Kurt Gray, there are ways to break the cycle of mutual mistrust. Read by Rachel Hanshaw.
Politics is a firestorm, sometimes literally. In 2023, in the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts, someone threw petrol on a pro-Trump sign nailed to a tree and set light to it. 3 years earlier, in the same area, a 49-year-old Trump supporter started a huge blaze after igniting some hay bales that were emblazoned with a pro-Biden sign. This bucolic area of Massachusetts is not known for arsonists. But both here and everywhere else in the world, it's as though people are consumed by hate. And it's not just America where liberals and conservatives seem to detest each other. A UK survey in 2017 found that both conservative and Labour supporters viewed the other side as much less intelligent, open-minded, and honest than their own. Only 24% and 19% respectively would be happy with their child marrying someone from the other side of the ideological divide. But is this hatred as intense as it looks? And is it in fact hatred or something else entirely? What is true is that our political opponents appear to hate us. Our meta-perceptions of them are very negative. Let me explain. Perceptions are what you think of the other side, and meta-perceptions are what you think the other side thinks about you. Crucially, research shows that our meta-perceptions are extremely miscalibrated. In other words, we believe they hate us far more than they do. In one study, the assumed distaste was exaggerated by about 25 points on a 100-point scale. Another found that hatred was overestimated by up to 300%. Here's why that's such a problem. We like those who seem to like us, and are inclined to hate those who seem to hate us, even if they don't. This is the principle of reciprocity, and it's also the reason people are willing to engage in anti-democratic practices. Evidence shows that the majority of people on the left and the right are in favor of transparent elections and against gerrymandering, for example, but reckon people on their side value these principles up to 88% more. This spells trouble, because when you believe your opponents are breaking the rules, you become willing to do so too. Thankfully, there's a way to interrupt that cycle. When people have their inaccurate meta-perceptions corrected, they show less partisan animosity. Likewise, reminding them that their opponents support democracy leads them to reaffirm their own commitment to democratic norms and express less support for anti-democratic candidates. Although it's clear that we often overestimate the amount of political hatred in the world, it's certainly the case that people on different sides often strongly dislike each other and will sometimes lash out. The other question, then, is why? One important reason is the setup of politics and elections, which are often a zero-sum game. When the system means your win is my loss, people are naturally going to get antagonistic. Of course, not all rivalry is bad. Athletes perform better when they compete against people or teams for whom they have animosity. But politics is not the same as sports. The whole purpose of sports is competition. And while elections are also competitive, we must all live together in the same society in the intervening years, governed by the same parties. Another reason we dislike our political opponents is because we tend to think they are immoral. Together with colleagues, I asked liberals and conservatives what they believed each grouping thought about obvious wrongs. Surprisingly, we discovered that people believed 15% of their opponents viewed sexually exploiting children as acceptable. In reality, almost everyone condemns it. It is also possible to see people on the other side as evil because they endorse policies that cause harm. In fact, all policies cause some harm, whether they concern tax, transport, immigration, or drugs. Every law or initiative involves messy trade-offs, costs and benefits that help some and cause suffering to others. Unfortunately, research shows that people believe their political opponents intend these unwelcome costs and relish the problems they cause. The key to understanding all this lies in our distant past. Though we often think of ourselves as apex predators, sitting at the top of the food chain, our ancestors lived in constant fear, more prey than predator. For the millions of years during which our minds evolved, we were stalked and hunted and terrorized by big cats, eagles, and packs of wolves. And even though we now live in relative safety, we cannot shake that pervasive sense of threat. With this knowledge about human nature, we can better understand why those people in rural Massachusetts set political signs on fire. They were not so much bent on mindless destruction as they were afraid, worried about their future and the future of the nation if the other side were to win. Of course, feeling afraid does not license violence or arson. It does not justify, but it can help explain. An environment that made us less afraid would clearly help. Unfortunately, there are many political actors determined to take advantage of our evolved fearfulness, stoking our sense of threat to gain advantage for themselves. We must try to hold fast to reality. They don't hate you as much as you think. They may be willing to cause harm, but mainly on the basis of reciprocity. They think that your side is the one that embraces chaos and destruction. The solution to this mutual misperception is to show each other that this is not the case and explain how our political beliefs are grounded in feelings of fear and concern. Work we've carried out shows that people are more willing to respect and engage with opponents who relate personal experiences of suffering and worries about what might happen to them in the future. So the next time you speak to someone who disagrees with you, spend less time accusing them of burning it all down and more time helping them to understand your beliefs as well as your fears, which at root are likely to be similar to theirs.
That was The Big Idea. Do Our Political Opponents Really Hate Us? By Kurt Gray. Read by Rachel Hanshaw. That's all from us. This has been Weekend, a Guardian podcast. If you're enjoying it, please make sure to like, subscribe to, and rate the podcast. Maybe even leave us a nice review, or let us know what you want to hear more of. Just search for Weekend wherever you get your podcasts. This week's articles are read by Carly Spear and Rachel Hanshaw, and presented by me, Savannah Ayode-Greaves. This episode was produced by Rachel Porter. The executive producer was Ellie Bury. Join us again next Saturday. Thanks for listening.
This is The Guardian.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.